taxation number 21552, Reel 7.
Raymond Venables, Reel 7. So you said there was about 8 officers on board?
Yes.
Could you tell me what their roles were individually?
There was an engineer officer who was usually up from the ranks, an ex-ERA, and really knew about the engines. Although one was RNR and from the Merchant Service, and they really were often Scotsmen, as in legend, and, you know, without them you were sunk with all hands. Then there was another one who was usually up from the ranks called the Gunner T. Mostly gunnery and torpedoes, but we didn't have any torpedoes. And he was usually known as Guns. And he was proper old Navy, who'd been rather belatedly made a warrant officer or one stripe or perhaps two. Then the other RN lieutenant, who was so helpful because he taught me how to navigate a ship at sea virtually, he was the signals officer, an ASDIC officer, and he's very good technically. If the ASDICs got bust at sea, you were useless, you couldn't do your job at all. He would mend them. He would mend anything. It was a slight snag sometimes because there was a sideboard in the wardroom with a beer rail around the top, and he did certain things, then you get a shock off the beer rail. But he was a splendid officer. He's one I've tried to get in contact with since, but I haven't managed to. And the rest would be watchkeeping officers without specialist jobs, except that one would be the office waller, because you didn't have specialist people to do the books. You had to do the books and do the pay, except that if he was on leave, for instance, I do it, maybe. I hated that too. And another one would be an education officer, which was me in this case. And then there was a sports officer, and that was me too. So you did various jobs. The most thing was, of course, you were a watchkeeper. You were up there on the bridge, sometimes two of you, when things were nasty, or sometimes just one. And the chief job was conning the ship, watchkeeping, and waking the captain if things got awkward.
Now, you mentioned that when you first joined the ship that you were off to the tropics for a long period.
Yeah.
Could you explain to me what happened there?
Yes, we went pretty quickly down to Freetown, and there were a lot of ships going into Freetown. It was sort of nice halfway between here and Cape Town and across the South Atlantic. It was quite an important base, a very good harbour. And they had a couple of depot ships there and quite a lot of ships in. And we did quite a lot of escorting from there and around there and just patrolling and looking for trouble, if any. There was one occasion I always remembered when there was a big armed merchant cruiser in there. You know, they put a few guns on, a big merchant ship, and one of their merits was they had huge food supplies. So they ring up, "Would you like some meat or something?" And I got a signal from RPC dinner tonight. Request pleasure of company in Naval Town at such and such a time from Lieutenant Bird. I thought, I don't know any Lieutenant Bird. Good Lord, my Uncle Albert. My Uncle Albert, at the age of 49, when the upper age was 50, had got himself a job as the kind of catering officer of this ship. And I went aboard, and it was a stateroom of a great big ship, and we were all dressed in our tropical, all very posh, and I was sitting at the captain's table when my uncle leant over and he said, "You know, this is all very well, but we both knew of this, where my grandfather lived, this little village in Rutland, and he said, I'd much rather be in Algie Baines's pub with a pint of beer and some bread and cheese and pickle. I've never forgotten that memory. How right he was.
Was there any incidents that occurred with this period while you were in Freetown doing the escort patrol?
Not so much there, no. Odd things like I think before I joined the ship, a Sunderland flying boat had run out of petrol, so we obligingly towed him into the Gambia in Bathurst. And so that when we went up the river to Bathurst, the RAF mess sort of sent down lorries and whisked us off to the party, to end all parties. Just as I didn't mention at Gibraltar, we had a party. You know, there's some extraordinary guns in Malta up at the top, and they work not on elevation but on depression. 9.2s, I reckon they were, and they had some chaps manning them who were known as the Rock Apes. I mean, they never came down. We once went up to have a party with them, and they were a most extraordinary lot of chaps. You met these oddments around in those days. Bathurst, I remember. We did pick up one chap who'd run out of petrol in his aircraft, but not much else. There wasn't a great deal of incident from the Freetown days, no.
Was he in a dinghy, the man you picked up in?
I think he was, yes, yeah.
And how had you adjusted to your roles then in this period? Because you mentioned that you had a number of roles, as well as watchkeeping while you were patrolling. How were you as the education officer and the sports officer? How were you getting along there?
Well, sports officer, nil, because there's nothing you could do. Education officer, I think it developed a bit more later. That was when I mentioned ABCA. These things, they all came round to all naval ships. And this was, I'm sure, a big difference between the last war and the one before that, because they were very keen that, that people shouldn't be demobilised and go back and have an absolute blank in their minds about what on earth was going on in their country, and it ought to be a better country. And so when, for instance, they had the Butler Education Act, there was a huge amount of stuff about it put out by ABCA, and we were told we must get the soldiers, sailors and soldiers together and tell them about it. So that I used to do.
How did you organise that?
Well, I used to say to the captain, can I talk to people about this? And we cleared lower deck. I think I do it in groups. Once I remember I did say, there's a lot of stuff flying about. Do you think people are a bit bored? Supposing we have a sort of any questions, it was called a brains trust, if you remember in those days, and I'll chair it and I'll get some chaps and we'll get people to send questions in and broadcast it all over the ship. And it was extremely funny, because the captain said, well, I thought that was all right, pilot, but I wasn't aware on one of HM ships that anyone should be suggesting the abolition of the House of Lords. It was pretty radical stuff. There was a chap, a great advertisement for Scottish education. He was a signalman and he was very bright. And we had a mixture of views and comments and questions and so on. That was one thing I did as education officer.
Did you organise lectures at all?
Not really, no. No, I didn't organise any lectures. I remember when, at the end of the war, I got everybody, I was as a divisional officer, I got everyone in my division and said they ought to vote because our forefathers, etc., etc., and then forgot for my own doubt, so I never did vote for Churchill, which I would have done. And I don't know if the sailors did, they probably voted Labour.
So in those early days, it was just developing, was it, really, at that period?
Yes, it was, yes. It certainly developed more as the war went along with, the introduction. I couldn't tell you when ABCA began to send its stuff out, but it sent out pamphlets and urged people to teach people and introduce people to this, that and the other. And we did it.
You mentioned dealing with pay as well when the other officer was on leave.
Yes.
What did that entail?
You may well ask. I remember one horrifying, I think it was in Belfast, and I went ashore, and you get, there's quite a lot of money, and it was sort of 500 quid or something, with a wrapper around it, and you have to bring it, and you have to put a buoy on it in case it drops overboard, and you can go find the buoy and pick it up. And I got it into the wardroom mess, and one or two of my colleagues were there, and I said, well, here's quite a lot of money, but, what do we care for money? And did a great rugby pass across the wardroom. He caught it. Then he passed it back. What do we care for money? And did a neat little punt. And I do assure you, every note got separated from every other note. And we spent the next hour picking this stuff up. And when it, sometimes it was awful because you had to... you're supposed to balance the books before the other chap. Whatever I did, there was 2 quid missing. So I said, oh, to hell with it, and stuck 2 quid in and forgot all about it. And a month later, a chap came down scratching. He said, I don't know what's happened to my account. Whatever I do, I'm 2 quid up. Give, I said. And we got them all square one way or another. But that was... You also had problems with, the supplies... There was rather too many supplies at one point, which you wrote off rather suspiciously because they had gone missing, but eaten by anchors, eaten by ants or something was the story. But I don't think I ever said that, but you usually found ways of writing things off if they'd gone missing. Because things do. I mean, in the services, things are just pinched. I don't think I did escape the service with a pair of binoculars and a couple of duffel coats, but a lot of people did.
So how long are you in this area patrolling off Freetown?
Again, I can't remember exactly, not very long, before we came back to...
Would this be early 42? Or?
Yes, it was. So then we did, it was about that time that we did... we escorted the Malaya, been damaged in Alexandria, I think, and we escorted her over to Norfolk, Virginia, to be repaired. We didn't take her to Norfolk, Virginia. We were detached from her, and we were going into Trinidad. And that was when we upended our first submarine. We were with 3 destroyers, 2 other destroyers, and they were both fleet destroyers, turned their beautiful noses up at this old vessel, which is what amused us. We were in line abreast, and suddenly the captain said, gosh... there's a whale blowing off over there, and we looked through our binoculars, and the ship put up the battle flag and vroom and hooted, and it wasn't a whale, it was a torpedo, which a foolish German submariner had fired at 3 destroyers in a line. And so we then settled down and did a box search. You reckon he can only do so many knots under the surface, so in an hour he can only get to there, and you put a box round and you go round and round without success. And so as night fell, the senior officer, one of these smart fleet destroyers, said, what we're going to do, we're going to leave the scene and come back at full speed at first light, because they have to come on surface. We hope to catch on the surface. A perfectly good plan, but of course we realise you haven't got enough fuel to do this kind of thing, so you better just stick around. And they'd hardly disappeared off the scene, and we got this thing on our radar, and we were much amused at the discomfiture of the 2 snooty fleet destroyers. And it was an extraordinary business, because the captain got a DSC for courage and enterprise in robbing, in sinking a submarine. But what actually happened was that we saw the thing, and he had a sudden worry that it might be a Bolivian submarine or something. We were near the East Coast, and I was looking through my binoculars and saying, I can remember as politely as possible, there's a bloody great swastika on the conning tower, sir. And so what happened was, this thing was going, we came in and out, and in the end, it would be slightly more accurate to say the submarine rammed us rather than we rammed the submarine. We went across its bows, it went down our port side, and rolled over and sank, and all the chaps jumped out, and we picked them up. And that's where my linguistic, such as they were, came up, because I was told I must interrogate the prisoners. You have to interrogate them. We got the confidential books out a bit quick, and what do you do with prisoners? And the first thing, while they're still wet and demoralised, you interrogate them. So you also, the doctor has to examine them for nasty diseases which might spread to your men. So we had the heron folk all up in a mass in the seamen's heads, and as they came up, I said, name, official number, and then Nama, Stavros number. Then I went on, name of the captain, oh, we didn't tell you that, number of the U-boat, we wanted to know these things. No, that's the Hunchnik 999, and so on. And so, and Doc was saying, take your pants off, and examining their scrotums and all that. And then he said, we don't keep not getting anywhere with these tough old pros, and that's what they're told to say, and that's what we're told to say. You give your name and official number, but let's wait till there's a more. And then there was some sort of poor, pathetic boy coming along. He looked far too young, and it was a shame to take the money. He spilled it all out. We got all the information.
Can you remember the U-boat's number?
I can't. I've got it down on a bit of paper here somewhere.
That's all right, we can look for it later.
Yeah.
How many casualties have been caused by when you'd rammed the U-boat?
Not very many. I think they nearly all got off it. I think the engineer and the couple down there went down with her. But what was extremely funny, I mean, in retrospect, I don't know how much I was laughing at the time, but the captain was still worried about his Bolivian submarine, so he said, you speak German, go and pull one of those men out of the water and ask him if he's German. And I actually got hold of a chap and said, sind Sie Deutsch? Ja, wohl, natürlich, he said. It was one of the more comic episodes of my life. And again, we had them on board. They lived with us, the officers lived with us, and they started off with a sailor, according to confidential books, on the door with a pistol in his belt. And these chaps said, well, I don't know where we're supposed to run away to. I said, no, it's not. It's not very easy, so we fell him out. And again, I sort of talked to them and sang German songs. And it's funny, you talked about, at one point, my colleagues said, come on, pilot, give them Hitler. And I said, because I used to do an imitation of Hitler with my hair down, like, you know, and a starry look in my eyes. And I had a little speech about, give it the demokratische Staatsmänner, and so on. And they were all trained to say, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, at the right moment. And I said, oh, no, it's not. These chaps have just fallen out of the drink. It's not much fun. And say, oh, come on, do it. So I did it. And they fell about with laughter. I've never seen people enjoy anything so much all my life. So I didn't feel so badly about hurting their feelings. It was very funny. And then we sang some songs, and one of them, a very famous one called Die Lorelei, we sang that with great Germanic passion. And then I said, do you know who wrote that? And they said, oh, it's anonymous. I said, it's not anonymous, it's only been anonymous since 1933, written by a Jew called Heine. Oh, they said. But when you tried to get them on politics, on Hitler, anything, what they said was, a thing which no English sailor would ever say. They'd say, "Ich bin gar kein Politiker," I'm not a politician. And then he'd say, "Ich bin Soldat," and no British sailor would say, "I'm a soldier." I'm a military man, but a Soldat in German means... But it struck me at the time, certainly not a Soldat. there it was. Again, we felt this thing, we felt almost more in common with them than the civilians back home.
Was their demeanour different from the raiders, the German raiders you'd captured when you were in Edinburgh?
Well, yes, because these were Navy, the others were merchant service. Anyway, I didn't have too much to do with them. These people we lived with for some time, till we deposited them in Trinidad, where there had been a lot of sinkings of ships by the... the submarines had sunk a lot of ships in the seas round there, and this was the first one that had been sunk for some time. When we went into Trinidad, we were known as the Hero Destroyer, and the Admiral's wife came on board and said, "Boys, I'm by way of being the senior wife present. How do you like them? Blonde, brunette, and so on." It was great fun in Trinidad. We had a lovely few days leave in Trinidad. But when we delivered them, these things, an entire battalion of American soldiery turned out, and I reckon the safety catches were off their automatic weapons, and it wasn't much fun.
Did you capture the captain?
Yes, and we didn't have to do with him, but our captain did, and liked him less than we liked the others, because sometimes U-boat captains were thoroughly indoctrinated, and apparently he was, and our captain did not care for him.
You mentioned your captain and getting the word. What was his name?
Descher. His brother was Somerset Descher, was a minister. He was in the Ministry of Supply, so if anything fell overboard, Dudley tended to say, "Oh, that's all right, my brother's Minister of Supply, we'll get another." Very funny.
And the award he was awarded?
I think he got a DSC.
Would that be common for the sinking of a submarine?
Yes. And he got he sank, when he left us, he sank a Japanese cruiser and got a bar to it or something.
So you captured these Germans, and did you see them more as... You mentioned that the demeanour was slightly different, but did you see them as quite seasoned U-boat men?
Yes, they were, yes, I reckon. And you saw them as fellow inhabitants of the North Bloody Atlantic. You felt extraordinary lack of enemy about them, especially as they were... You know, no more thrilled with Hitler than we were.
Would you say that's again the question of the sea being...
Yes, it unites people. Yes, and you spend your life. I mean, the chief time you're not fighting the Germans. You're fighting the ruddy sea. That's what you spend most of your time doing, and so would they. So you've got this in common.
So you'd arrived in Trinidad, you deposited the German. What happened next?
Then we, having had a quite fun stay in Trinidad, we escorted four or five tankers to, which I was told afterwards, fueled almost the entire North African landings. They were five tankers, and we took them up through Gibraltar. We saw them through the Straits of Gibraltar and then went on home.
Who were you escorting the tankers with? Was there other
vessels? Other destroyers, yes. Mm.
When you were escorting tankers, were there any particular dangers of escorting tankers as opposed to other merchant vessels?
Yes. I mean, mostly to them. I mean, because they loved sinking tankers more than anything. And people who were on tankers sort of a worse chance of getting away with it if they blew up. But it didn't happen to the escorts. I mean, one's bound to say in the escorts, you did have the feeling that on the whole they weren't trying to get you, they were trying to get the ships you were trying to protect.
You mentioned very briefly the box formation. Was there any, at that stage, obviously anti-U-boat tactics were evolving.
Mm.
Were they, was the box formation the usual thing you would use, or were there other?
Well, no, there would be mostly that one, because if you last saw a U-boat there, and you reckoned submerged, it can go 3 knots. So you draw a ring round it, or a box, roughly around it, of, you know, that's how it can go, far it can go in an hour. And so the, you then start doing searches like this, all around it and going inwards. I don't think that changed at the end of the war. I mean, it's other things changed, like the weapons you used, and radar got better and so on. But the actual box search, I imagine, I think they'd still do a box search.
With the weapons at the time, what were you armed with for anti-submarines at that particular point?
Well, we had one still 4-inch gun forward. We had some Oerlikon guns around the bridge. We had, and the chief armament, the torpedoes had gone, used to have torpedoes, it had got 14 charge depth charge pattern, which in those days you can see the problem. You set them with depth settings, which is a question of guessing, different depths, so they would go off at different depths. Your Aztecs went forward like this, and as you came in, you got a sort of boom sound, and when it hit a U-boat, it went boop, boop, like this. And one of the things you'll be able to, I remember coming back to me, something called the Doppler effect. If it went boop, it meant it was going away from you. If it went boop, it meant it was going towards you. So there was some indication. And meanwhile, the Aztec chap was telling me on the plot where these bearings were, and I was plotting them, and I'd say to him, this thing looks to me as if it's steering such and such a course and such a speed. But right at the end, as you came in, you had to, if he was doing this, you had to aim in front of him so that the things went down the side there, and you had to drop the thing so that the pattern, he would steam into your pattern.
So you would try and cut across
his bows.
His bows and then drop behind you.
And drop you behind. And since it took quite a long time to drop, there was something like, you know, 200 yards or something like that, you were out of communication with him. And the good U-boat commanders knew this perfectly well. And when they realised you were 200 yards away, they would do an acute alteration, of course, and steam out of your pattern. So you can see the importance of the invention of the hedgehog, which is a head-throwing thing, which you were still in contact when you fired it. And then after that, they mixed the two and produced the squid, which did both. It went up. The hedgehog was just on contact. And the only effect we ever had with hedgehog that we let it off once for some reason in the channel, it produced a lot of dead fish. But the squid went down and exploded at different depths.